Got a really nice smile. He could sell things on TV. I believe you are, he finally said, and Brian let out his breath as Flicka headed for the stairs. Brian watched as Flicka made it to the top of the stairs, and he immediately got up off the wall and started booking north along one of the park paths. Just as he saw the kiosk around the bend in the path up ahead, he looked at his phone to see that Marvin was calling him. What the hell are you doing, Brian? Marvin said. Is it true you met with Flicka? What the hell? I'm mending this, dude, Brian said as he ran. What do you mean? You can't do it, so I am. That's what friends are for, right? I'll call you back. Brian dropped his cell into his pocket as he arrived at the battered payphone. He lifted the receiver and heard a dial tone. It had to be one of the last working payphones in all Manhattan, maybe the world. He quickly dialed.
911, what's your emergency?
Asked the female operator.
I just saw a guy with a gun in his hand in Riverside Park, a tall black guy in a black goose down jacket. He's getting into a Mercedes on Riverside Drive, plate number 347WRT. He's near the Soldiers and Sailors Monument. Hurry. Do you want to leave your name?
The operator wanted to know. Brian thought about the dealer again, the sheer, horrendous size of him.
Not in any way, shape, or frickin' form, ma'am, Brian Bennett said before he hung up the phone with a sharp clang and continued running.
Chapter 64. At 7 that night, I was in the company Impala with Seamus, scanning the empty dark streets around my building, looking for Brian. I was starting to get nervous. Actually, if you wanted to get truly technical, I was on the brink of a massive panic attack. The tires squealed as we came off 89th onto Amsterdam Avenue with some speed. We zipped past a Thai restaurant, a pizza parlor, a dive bar.
Wait, maybe he went into that bar back there, Seamus, I said. Do you think we should stop?
No, I don't, Seamus said calmly.
He's 16, he's just walking around. It's going to be fine. We'll find him, Michael, soon.
Why do kids do this, father? I said. Drive their parents so sick with worry.
But I remember when you were young, Seamus said. Your parents beamed as you shined your shoes and whistled as you made your way back and forth from choir to altar boy practice. You never worried anyone to death with all your wild hooligan carryings on.
It was a different time back then, I said in my defense. Everything wasn't so nuts.
All right you are, Seamus said. In the 70s and 80s, this city was a moral paradise. If you recall, Michael, it's only natural for a boy to gravitate toward shenanigans. Why, it was only yesterday your father and I were out looking for you. When you went to, what was it called, laser something in Central Park, and blind my eyes if we weren't in his squad car then as well.
Laser Zeppelin, I said, laughing, at the Hayden Planetarium. Give me a break, Seamus, that was educational. I remembered it vaguely. It was a laser light show across the dome of a huge dark room where the immortal Zepp was blasted at an unbelievable volume. Teens would tailgate, sipping tequila and beer in the park outside every Friday night, and my friends and I would go join the festivities, trying to get girls' phone numbers. As I strolled down memory lane, I suddenly remembered my own father. Murder in his eyes by a park bench when I came back from upchucking in the bushes.
Not fair, Seamus, I said as I continued cruising down Amsterdam, my head on a swivel.
How dare you bring up at a time like this the fact that I, too, was 16 once. We did another circuit around the apartment and onto Riverside Drive, and I spotted blue and red spinning lights somewhere in the high 80s. As I zoomed up, I could see that cops had cuffed a big figure in a goose-down jacket and were putting him up over the hood of a Mercedes. Thank God it wasn't Brian, I thought, driving past. Then a minute later, there he was, on the corner of 96th, waiting to cross at the light.
Hey, Dad. Hey, Seamus, he said casually as I screeched up in front of him.
Get your butt in this car, now! I twisted around toward the back as he sat, and I looked deep into his eyes.
One chance. What are you on? I said,
He gaped at me. "Nothing, Dad, I swear. I went out for a walk. My phone died. I must have lost track of time. Jeez."
"Better your phone than you, you idiot," I said. "You're up to something. Your brother is sick with whatever it is. What the hell is going on in my house? I want answers."
"It was nothing. I went to the library and I met my friend. We just started walking and talking."
"Which friend?"
"Rob from the football team. He came down to the city from Westchester and we were just chilling. He just hopped in a cab the second you showed up."
I squinted at him. "Brian, people lie to me all day. I need to get it at home, too."
"I swear, Dad, please call him if you don't believe me."
"And listen to what? What you told him to say? No thanks."
"Leave it for now,"
Seamus whispered, leaning over toward me.
"Remember the lasers, Michael."
I rolled my eyes as I ripped the tranny into drive and hit the gas. Seamus was right, and not for the first time.
Chapter 65. President Buckland heard the trill of the Sikorsky VH-60N White Hawk's rotor lower in pitch as the two Secret Service agents on the midnight shift softly closed the Rose Garden doors behind him. As he cleaned his shoes on the mat and walked down the warm carpeted corridor, he thought about the Secret Service and the two young full-dressed Marines who had just popped the double doors of Marine One for him. Thought about all the Americans out there in the cold and dark around the world, manning their posts. In the beginning, it had been difficult to accept all the fuss and ceremony of the job, but then he realized it wasn't about him. The fact that spit-shine Marines would greet him with a salute at 3 o'clock in the cold morning was just a small symbol of the extraordinary lengths they would go to protect their country. The dedication and full commitment of America's first responders never failed to humble and inspire him. He made a right at the end of the corridor and found the basement stairs. His chief of staff had texted during his late meeting at Langley that Buckland's presence was requested in the White House kitchen, which could only mean one thing. Some trick his wife was pulling, of course. 43 years of age, and she still loved tricks and pranks, even here in the White House. Upstairs in their personal quarters, she would hide on him from time to time, like an overgrown 3-year-old. As he approached the kitchen, he looked around for Danny, the workaholic head chef. Even at 3 a.m., he probably wasn't too far away, waiting for the president and his wife's little moment to be over, so he could have his kitchen back. The kitchen was dark but for one pendant light shining down on his wife, who was sitting at one of the stainless steel prep counters, smiling and beautiful in her robe and slippers. He watched as she quickly slipped her rosary beads back into her pocket. She had always been a woman of faith, but ever since he'd gotten the big job, she'd become even more so. He prayed from time to time, but it was a constant with her. He sat beside her and kicked off his shoes. "And what the heck is this now?" Buckland said to his wife. "It's the middle of the night." "Don't tell me you forgot," she said.
"Forgot what?"
"Our anniversary." "That's in June," Buckland said, throwing up his hands.
"Not that one," she said. "The other one, silly."
She pushed over the covered silver tray beside her. He took off the cover, and his mouth fell open as he saw the two Klondike bars on the tray.
"Oh, that one," he said, laughing.
He remembered it like it was yesterday. He had prepared a special dinner for the two of them, loin lamb chops and garlic mashed potatoes, on a plastic table on the balcony of his crummy first apartment near his first post in Tucson. The balcony overlooked the parking lot of a Goodwill store, but it had looked like the Champs-Élysées seen from the window of the nicest hotel in Paris when she sat down across from him, done up in the little black dress she'd worn for the occasion. Dessert, which they had only gotten around to the morning after, had been two Klondike bars melted to mush on the kitchen counter. Buckland smiled.
How long ago had that been? He suddenly thought about all of it. The summers and Christmases and dozens of birthdays, first together and then with her kids. All that fun and joy. The fullness of the life they had had because they had somehow found each other. People talked about his heroic accomplishments, but no one knew that every one of them had been because of her. She was the one who had fulfilled his potential. He had simply been lucky enough to have found someone to be a hero for.
"I was going to use this as a way to beg you not to go to New York," his wife said, "but that would be useless. In fact, selfish. Our country needs you to go. The world does. Putin is a wolf. It's time he learns what a sheepdog is all about. Somebody has to do it, and that's you."
She shook his hand and led him through the darkened kitchen toward the elevator. "But wait, what about the Klondike bars?" he said.
"Tomorrow morning, Mr. President. We have to do this right, remember?"
Chapter 66. The bright white rectangle of the TV screen lit up in the darkness, and then the video was rolling. The footage opened up on the long gray carpet of a downward-sloping New York City cross street near the United Nations in the Turtle Bay neighborhood east of Madison Avenue. The Midtown South Side street was unnaturally clear of traffic and parked cars, and there were steel pedestrian barriers, as one would see at a parade, completely lining the curbs in both directions. By the gold tinge to the light in the short sleeves and summer dresses of the handful of pedestrians behind the barriers, it appeared to be a summer evening. At the top of Madison Avenue in the distance, through the suffused light, appeared the silhouette of a uniformed cop with his arms folded, his back to the street. Then the vehicles came over the rise. A blue and white marked NYPD cop car came first, its flashing and blinking lights barely perceptible in the twilight. It moved by quickly, 45, maybe 50 miles an hour. It was followed by an equally rapidly moving black Chevy Suburban, then a blue and white marked NYPD SUV, and then an NYPD tow truck. Behind the tow truck came another black speeding Suburban SUV, and then another, and then another.
"How many bloody cars are there again?"
the British assassin's wife said as they watched in the dark of the old office.
"Altogether 54,
the assassin said.
"Shh, watch."
There was a break in the motorcade for nearly a minute, and then a rumble began. Seconds later, in a phalanx of blinking red and blue, there were NYPD motorcycle cops, half a dozen in a loose V, followed by more and more cop cars and vans and SUVs. Finally, a full 4 minutes into the video, down the slope came what everyone was waiting for. Pedestrians at the curb began lofting phones and waving plastic American flags as what was referred to as the Beast, the first of two massive presidential Cadillac limousines, barreled over the rise. The assassin hit the pause button on the remote.
"Right there, you see,"
the assassin said, pointing behind the barrier to the right of the limo.
"It happens right there." "Oh, I see. That's brilliant. You've outdone yourself. I can picture it now. Out of nowhere, like that, when it happens, it's just going to be bedlam,"
the assassin agreed. He got off the couch and went to the small washroom and clicked on the light and began scrubbing out the oil beneath his fingernails with lava soap and a brush. They were at the rented workshop in Brooklyn, and they'd just finished all the final adjustments on the dump truck. Everything was ready. Everything was in place. Disguises, equipment, distances, now vehicles. Done, 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 and done.
"And the route is confirmed," his wife said at his back. "Our contact is in the Secret Service, love,"
he said, glancing at his fingernails and switching the brush to his other hand.
"They know before the president himself does. It can't be stopped, then. It's done. We've done it."
The British assassin rinsed his hands and smiled at his reflection, then came back into the room. He finished the Gatorade he'd been drinking and bank shot the bottle into the wastebasket along the old office's brick wall.
The toy soldier has been wound, doll. Now it's just a matter of pushing the button.
In the glow of the pause screen image, the assassin's wife pulled off her shirt. She wasn't wearing a bra. She lay back on the couch, staring at him with her feline gray eyes. As he watched her slip out of her jeans, the British assassin imagined the new Italian racing red Jag XFRS he was going to buy when the final payment came. The rumble of its 500-plus horsepower under his palm, the way it would drift on the hairpins above the Mediterranean.
"Then what are you waiting for?" his wife said in the glow. "Push away."
Chapter 67. It was Saturday, and down on the field, a bunch of thin dudes in baby blue uniforms milled around another crew of skinny guys wearing all-white uniforms. The crowd around me suddenly roared as a light blue guy with girly hair booted the ball with a loud champagne cork-popping sound. The spinning ball made a surprisingly sharp curve through the air as it streaked for the top right corner of the goal. Then the crowd groaned as the ball banged off the goal's top bar and spun out of bounds. As I watched the slow-mo replay of the corner kick up on the massive jumbotron above Yankee Stadium's center field wall, I couldn't decide which was more surprising, that I was actually at a professional soccer game or that the soccer game was sacrilegiously occurring down on the hallowed outfield grass of my beloved Bronx Bombers.
"Gee, get out of here. There wasn't a goal made?"
I said sarcastically to Arturo beside me. We were standing in the cold of the open terrace-level seating, just below the stadium's upper deck on the third base side. Around us, a crowd of about 30,000 surrounded the improvised soccer field, set up foul pole to foul pole in the baseball stadium's outfield. "Tell me, is there ever a goal in soccer?" I said. "Or is zip-zip the point? Is it like a Zen thing?"
"Soccer no longer exists, Mike," Arturo said as he lifted his binoculars. "It's called football now, and it's the world sport, so get into it."
"Oh, I do, Arturo," I said, lifting my own binocs. "But only when it's played properly, on Sundays by men with upper body strength who wear helmets." I was on my way home from another fruitless day of not finding the assassin the night before, when Arturo had called me. Arturo, a soccer fan, had heard on the radio about the Saturday exhibition match between the new New York City Football Club and a team from England called Leeds United. Leeds United, as it turned out, was a team from Northern England, precisely where our shooter was supposed to be from. Coming here this afternoon with Arturo to look for him was a long shot, I knew. Under normal circumstances, I'd say there was probably no chance in hell that a public enemy number one on the run would do something as nuts as pop by and cheer on his home team. But then again, this was no normal crook. I'd been studying up on these warrior sniper types, and the thing about them was, although they were extremely precise and patient, they truly had no problem with risk. Things like grenades without pins, tight ropes with no nets, and jumping out of perfectly good aircraft were, for some reason, incredibly alluring to them. Risk was how they got their rocks off. Also, a plus point, probably the only one, was that the CIA had actually dug up another, slightly better photo of the Brit, standing in the crowd at some Middle Eastern market. He was wearing aviator sunglasses, but the shape of his nose and ears and jaw were clearer. Better than that, the smug frown on his face and the way he held himself, with a kind of shoulders-back, arrogant swagger, were quite distinctive. I studied the photo for the 1,000th time, the features, the demeanor and carriage. Then I lifted my binoculars and went back to scanning the crowd. If he was here, we could find him. Maybe. I panned over the sea of baby blue. Though the mostly male crowd jumped up and down a lot and did weird chants as they drank beer, they struck me as, rather than violent Euro-hooligans, clean-cut fellows who had probably played soccer in high school and college. Good-natured enough. Well, except for the idiots who insisted on constantly blowing
those stupid, head-splitting vuvuzela horns that sounded like bees buzzing. After another minute of not finding the needle in the haystack, an air horn went off near us at eardrum-perforating volume as another baby blue guy failed to kick the ball into the goal. "Take me out to a real ball game," I sang under my breath as I put my Nikon Binox back up to my eyes. I saw it a nanosecond later. I aimed the glasses down on the main level almost directly by first base and kept them there. "No," I said, spinning the target into focus. "No."
"What is it, Mike?"
"Come on," I said as I jogged up the stairs for the concourse. "Hurry up." Chapter 68. The British assassin smiled at the curvy brunette waitress with big black-rimmed eyes as she stopped before him with a tray filled with bottles of Budweiser and champagne in flutes. He was going to grab a few lagers, but then his wife elbowed him and he thought again. A second later, another chesty serving wench brought caviar and hot dogs. This one was a no-brainer. He liberally sprinkled beluga onto 2 francs. "Welcome to America," he said to his wife, after a surprisingly tasty bite. They were in luxury suite 321 on Yankee Stadium's private level, and it actually fit its ridiculous billing. It had leather seats and couches, flat screens everywhere, a pine-scented private loo. The suite even had a heated balcony overlooking the field, which was coming in quite handy now, this far into November. Leeds United American debut was a true to-do of the old school, so it was filled with posh expat Brits and even richer real Brits from the other side of the pond in the Northern Territories. There were obnoxious Brit big oil crooks, and obnoxious Brit big media crooks, and obnoxious Brit too big to fail central banking crooks who lent them other people's money. Coming in, they'd almost knocked down a former Brit supermodel famous for getting busted snorting heroin on the Prime Minister's plane. There was even an old rock star from the early 80s, drunk off his ass in one corner, slurring into the ear of a bitchy Brit magazine publisher who talked on the news shows from time to time. It was the wife's idea, of course. An old friend of hers from boarding school had married a Leeds boy who'd stepped in it, and was actually a minor owner of Leeds United. So here they were. His wife was all about status, social networking, moving up the ladder. He couldn't care less. Whatever she wanted, he was no dummy. As it turned out, happy wife, happy life applied even to hired killers. Besides, he was in a fairly good disguise, having dyed his hair silver gray to go along with his fake goatee. With some artfully placed stage makeup, he easily looked 10 years older than his 39 years. They had done their homework. They could squeeze in a quick drink or two now that everything was set up, especially for the one and only Leeds United. Then the lady of the private suite came by and grabbed his wife, and he stepped out onto the field balcony, from which he saw that Leeds U was inexplicably still tied up with the American hacks. He had to say, the stadium was impressive. The vastness of it, the scope, and yet everything clean and crisp and polished, no expense spared. He looked down at the white scalloped frisee that rimmed the top of the venue, down the bowl of the terrace seating that increased in price the closer you got to the field. Something ancient Rome about it, all the different classes and separated seating, senators and knights in the front row, sweaty plebes and slaves back in the bleachers. Come one and all to cheer the bloody circus.
"We might be scum, but we never run. Leeds, Leeds, Leeds,"
said the wife's friend's boorish ass of a hubby, Terry Richjerk, as he came out onto the terrace in his smart tailored jacket and posh jeans.
"You know, I haven't been this pumped up since me and the boy sent a manhole cover through a pub window in Millwall," he said, reeking of scotch as he clapped a British assassin on the back.
He was referring, as so many others like to do, to the legendary brawl between Leeds and Millwall fans in 2007. Only problem was that Terry, like so many others, hadn't been there, the assassin knew. As one of the top headbreakers in the Leeds service crew, the gang of hooligans who had supported Leeds U since the mid-90s, he never missed a game when he wasn't abroad. There'd been no manhole covers through pub windows that day, but he and a few chums had set a chip fan alight when things started getting interesting. Come to think of it, he'd actually broken a canine cop's arm with a length of black pipe when her evil bloody dog bit his friend. The British assassin smiled as he lifted his flute.
"The good old days," he said.
"Sally was saying you were in the Royal Marines, was it?"
The British assassin nodded vaguely. Terry peered at him with his red face.
"What are you in now? Corporate security?"
"Executive protection, they call it these days," the assassin said.
"You need an armored S-class? Tell Sally I know a guy."
The British assassin looked at Terry as he laughed. He was an upper VP at the Bank of England, the Bank of Bloody England. Who the fat sot had to strangle in order to finagle his way into the upper realms of finance, where the real players pulled the strings, loaning to governments and setting the currency rates as they saw fit out of thin fucking air, was beyond him. And the whole government-approved scam run for everyone in the small exclusive club, getting richer and richer 24/7, 365, year in, year out, no matter if rain fell from the sky or buckets of burning lava.
"It's shit, New York,"
Terry mused as he drunkenly looked at the crowd.
"In it? I mean, London is shit too, but this is worse. Now they're playing football like it's some kind of progress. Don't they know bloody Liberia has football? It's like they actually want to become a third-world crap hole. Anyway, where did you grow up? In Leeds proper?"
"Off the York Road in Seacroft. You?"
"The other side, in Bramley. You're in Brighton now," Sally said.
"Yep," he lied.
"Well, you have to come by the place in town some Friday night and reminisce."
The place in town, the assassin knew, being a townhouse mansion in the Boltons in Chelsea, where the gated pile started at about 20 million quid.
"Well, that sounds like it might be nice, Terry," he said as he gave another smile.
"Who knows? Maybe we could do a little business,"
Terry said with a wink.
"You never know when the Merc might be in the market for a new machine gun."
Chapter 69. Some inebriated young woman sloshed half a microbrew onto my shoes as I made my way through row C near the first base side of the main seating level. At the end of the row, I came down two steps and knelt in the aisle and tapped the shoulder of a light blue-clad gentleman sitting at the end of row A.
"Hey, how's it going, buddy?" I said.
CIA operative Matthew LaRue smiled broadly as he looked at me. Beside him, his blonde wife, Sophie, also clad in blue, rolled her eyes. They, like Arturo and I, were both sporting some pretty expensive-looking binoculars, I noticed.
"Mike, buddy, small world," LaRue said. "You a big New York City soccer fanatic, too?"
"Oh, the biggest," I said. "I still have my Pele Cosmos lunchbox from second grade."
"No way, original owner, huh? I had to buy mine on eBay," LaRue said.
"But I just bought this nifty supporter blue scarf. What do you think?"
"Stylish, it goes with your eyes," I said.
"I see you've brought your wife, LaRue." I turned to her.
"I'm Mike, Detective Mike Bennett."
"Oh, I remember you, Detective,"
the pretty blonde woman said, peering at me. I peered back at the intelligence in her green eyes. There was something else there, too, I could see. Something still and cold and dangerous. I suddenly remembered the blood-splattered Hamilton Heights crime scene and how this petite, friendly woman had more than likely done some of the splattering. Were all CIA couples this nuts? I thought.
"All in the family, huh?" I said.
"All in every day, Mike," LaRue said, taking a sip from his Bud Light.
I hear that the family that watches soccer together stays together.
LaRue smiled.
Couldn't agree more, he said, looking around. Think the visiting team has a chance?
I said. Overconfidence will get you every time, LaRue said.
You would know, I said. Sophie, still scanning with her field glasses, suddenly tapped LaRue on the arm.
Third base side under the upper deck, the luxury booth, 12 o'clock.
I lifted my own glasses along with LaRue. I looked over at third base, then panned up. There were half a dozen men standing on a railed balcony. I scanned their faces, then looked at the photo, then looked back.
Third from the left, I said, isn't he a bit old?
Same nose and jaw, Sophie said.
Same cocky bearing and frown, too, I said.
What do you think, Matt?
LaRue focused his glasses, then stood.
They say close enough for government work, Mike, he said. Give me your phone.
He quickly typed his number into my contacts.
We'll take the right flank, you take the left. Call me when you get on the luxury level, and don't call for backup yet.
This guy's slippery. He'll know if something's up with security.
Hold up a second, I said.
What are you going to stop him with? Your new scarf?
Don't you worry about us, LaRue said, patting his wife's bag as they moved out of the row into the aisle. Let's just get up into position before he figures it out.
Chapter 70. From the deck of the luxury balcony, they heard the Yanks down in the section beneath cheering as one of the Leeds players got a yellow card for a hard tackle.
Oh, I hope he didn't rip his panties,
the drunken has-been rock star yelled as he hurled a plastic cup of beer at the blue-clad crowd beneath.
Piss off, you useless lot of bearded hipster wankers!
All the men out on the now-crowded balcony started laughing at that. Then Terry's arm was around the British assassin's shoulder, and he put his over the shoulder of the rock star, and it was like a time machine. As if they were all 17 again, jumping up and down with the Leeds, Leeds, Leeds chant. Terry pinched the waitress's ass as he grabbed another bubbly. The British assassin drained his champagne and took a breath and drank it all in, there in the cold above the crowd. This was the life. One more trigger pull, and he'd get the sour he'd been sucking all his life out of his mouth once and for all. He felt it a second later, right as he placed his empty on the tarch tray. It was like a tingle along the nape of his neck, a sixth sense. He glanced around left and right, down into the crowd below without moving his head. There were eyes on him. Of all those eyes, someone was watching him. It wasn't possible that he knew it, but it was true. He was a watcher, and he knew. He could feel it. He'd seen it happen often enough to targets. The glass would come on them, and they'd suddenly run, dive, duck. There was something psychic between a hunter and his prey. Now he was the one being spotted. He looked down to the left, on the stairs two sections below. A guy was heading up them, a guy in a suit, cop all over him. He sucked in a breath, felt the hard beat of his heart in his chest as he held the breath. He'd screwed up, big time. They shouldn't have come here. He needed to get out, now. He slowly stepped back inside. He got his wife's attention and then touched his ear, giving her the bug-out signal. They had planned contingencies to split up and regarding where to meet later. At least they weren't looking for her. Her eyes widened with a rare expression of fear, and then he was moving for the door. There was no one yet out in the luxury level hall. The level had its own private elevator on the left, but that would be the first thing they'd be onto. On his right, he saw a waitress go through a staff-only door. Following her, he saw that there was a small kitchen and wet bar behind it, and another door on the other side of the room.
Sir, can I help you?
The waitress said by the sink as he crossed the room. He kept going. The new door led to a narrow, slightly curving back corridor. There were garbage bags and a gray plastic rolling bin on the right,
As he hurried toward it, he saw the stainless steel threshold of a freight elevator just beyond it. He poked his head in. Except for a mop and a yellow rolling bucket, the elevator was empty. Better yet, the car's security key was in the console. He stepped in and turned the key and hit the main level button. The elevator spilled him out into the great hall by gate 6 where he had come in. He faced the cavernous space and headed for the gate, walking steadily toward the dozen stadium security guards standing there. He swallowed as he got closer and saw that there were two NYPD uniformed cops standing with the guards. He took a breath as he approached and forced himself to glance at them. They weren't on their radios. They didn't seem any more alert than usual. A sudden roar from the crowd boomed out low and muffled in the high-ceiling concourse.
"It's okay," he mentally coached himself. "Just walk out. They don't know yet. 50 meters, you can do this. Just calmly walk past them."
He was outside in the plaza, 50 meters on the other side of the ratcheting turnstile, when he heard the yell at his back.
"Stop that guy in the white hoodie! Stop him!"
He didn't turn around. Instead, he just moved north quickly, yet still passably casually. There were 100 or so people moving around souvenir vendors and hot dog carts to hide among. Then, as he reached the corner of 161st Street and River Avenue, where the elevated track was, he suddenly bolted beneath it. He'd made it across River Avenue and was booking around the corner of the stair entrance for the uptown side of the subway when he almost ran straight into the uniformed beat cop coming at a run from the other side with his partner.
"Hey, yo, stop!"
the beefy Asian cop said, reaching out with his palm. Instead of stopping, the Brit kept coming and seized the cop's hand and yanked hard, breaking two of his fingers. Then he reached and grabbed the baton out of his belt and cracked the other cop, a short, Hispanic-looking woman, across the bridge of her nose. He brought the baton whistling back across at the first cop, breaking his wrist, as the Glock the guy was in the process of trying to pull from his holster clattered across the concrete. The assassin scooped up the semi-auto as he ran north up the incline of 161st. He needed to make the corner, he thought, as he flat-out sprinted toward it, past shocked pedestrians out in front of the small, ugly, run-down stores. Just the first corner, he thought, his thighs and lungs beginning to burn. The supersonic crackle of a bullet suddenly passed less than an inch to the left of his ear.
No! They were going to shoot him down in the back as he was running, the bastards?
The first bullet was followed by another that shattered the glass side of the phone kiosk on his left as he passed it. Then he was around the corner, pulling off his hoodie, sweat flying and arms pumping in the cold as he ran for his life.
Chapter 71. Racing out of the stadium, I ran under the L on River Avenue and was 20 feet behind Matthew LaRue when he suddenly hopped up on the grass median between the lanes on 161st Street. A woman across the street screamed as he produced a suppressed pistol and began firing right there in broad daylight at the sprinting Brit up the block.
"Are you crazy? Put that damn thing away! You're gonna kill someone!"
I yelled, smacking the barrel of his gun down as I arrived.
"You're right, I am. The president's assassin," he yelled back as he hopped off the median and started running north after the Brit.
"Arturo,"
I said as he and Sophie caught up to me.
"The Brit just turned the corner and is heading south. You guys head south downriver in case he tries to come around the block."
People were coming out of the stores to gape as I ran up the north side of 161st Street behind LaRue. I thought I was pretty fast for my age, but LaRue was incredible. The commando was pulling away at an embarrassing clip. I finally followed around the first corner onto Girard Avenue and spotted LaRue in the middle of the street, already halfway down the block. Then he suddenly turned into an alleyway between two buildings on the right. As I got to the entrance of the alley, I heard a clatter of metal and looked up. On the third floor fire escape, I locked eyes with the gray-haired guy I'd just seen on the luxury balcony in Yankee Stadium for a split second.
I reared back in a kneeling dive to the asphalt as he pointed the Glock he was clutching. As the passenger window of a parked moving truck I'd just been standing beside exploded glass in my face, I scrambled out of a line of fire to the right. When the shock wore off enough for me to get my own gun out and hazard another peek upward into the alley, the Brit was gone. Instead, I saw LaRue bucking up the fourth-floor stairs of the brown, rusted zigzag of the tenement fire escape like it was an Olympic event, and he was going for the gold. Instead of taking the fire escape, I ran inside the building through its lobby to its east side stairwell and began running up. An emergency alarm went off when I banged open the roof door, huffing and puffing a minute later. Gasping for breath, I looked around the roof for LaRue or the Brit. To my right, 10 feet away, was the edge of the building's roof, the gap over a narrow alleyway, and then the edge of the roof of another building to the north. Had they hopped the gap? I wondered as I went to the edge, searching the next roof for any sign of either man. I knew the answer to that was affirmative when I heard a gun pop twice on the other side of some huge AC units on the north building's rooftop. My phone rang a second later.
I got him, Mike!
LaRue screamed. He's pinned on top of the building to the north. He's cornered around the housing for the building's elevator, northwest corner. There are no more fire escapes, no more nothing. Call for backup, the cavalry, airstrikes, everything you got. I'll sit tight so he doesn't go anywhere. Hurry! We finally got him!
Chapter 72.
No, no, bloody no!
The British assassin had come around the housing of the elevator equipment on the roof, hoping for a fire escape, but there was none. Over the edge of the north side of the building was a sheer four-story drop onto the roofs of the buildings on 161st that he'd run past. Worse, at the rear west side of the building, there was a five-story drop down into a concrete alley behind the building. He crouched down in the corner, gripping the Glock as he stared at the brick edge of the elevator structure. He was going to die here. In 1 second, the professional who was chasing him was going to pop his gun around that corner and rake half a dozen 9mm into his chest and blow him away. He just had to see the bloody game, didn't he? Idiot! Now this was it. The place of his death, he thought, staring up at the gray sky. This rooftop on some crumbling wasteland of a filthy Bronx block that was the color of burned charcoal. It wasn't supposed to happen like this, it really wasn't. It just wasn't fair. He peeked out over the rim of the roof to his right as a train went by on the rusted elevated track far below on River Avenue. Then he shot a quick glance farther right, up over the elevator housing, where some ugly cell site antennas were mounted. He peeked out again at the back of the building and saw that the thin, fiber-optic cabling and electrical cords of the antennas dropped straight down, all the way to the concrete alley. It was possible that if he hung down off the building's rim with his hands, he could hang, swing, and jump and just be able to grab the cables. Possible. The question was, would they hold his weight? Would his 170 pounds rip the cables free from wherever they were attached on the antennas? He pictured himself falling to his death, trailing the antennas. Then he paused. He closed his eyes, envisioning himself actually doing it. Edging over, jumping, grabbing the cables. There was no more time. He had no other choice. He got up and tucked the Glock into his waistband. Then he straddled the terracotta rim of the building and hung down off the back of it with his belly against the brick. The sensation of hanging out there in the breeze, being held by only his palms, was a very, very bad one. It didn't improve an iota as he began to move, right hand first, then left hand, then right. When he ran out of room where the roof edge met the wall of the elevator house, he commenced swinging his legs to his left and back to build up some momentum. When he did it the third time as he swung to the right, he pushed sideways with all his might off the rim and let go. He'd never felt his adrenaline spike higher as he free fell in midair, with dirty old bricks scraping at the tip of his nose. There was air, and then his hands were in the vine-like cluster of black plastic cables. His fingers were squeezing and his palms were burning as the vinyl cables sizzled through them. He gasped as a cable tie took the skin clean off his entire right pinky, but he didn't let go. He was able to hook his right boot down into the cable cluster, and he was suddenly slowing. And then, a miraculous second later, he was no longer falling at all. The now swinging cable made a creaking sound under his weight. He began laughing uncontrollably as he descended hand over bloody hand down the length of the building like the world's largest, happiest monkey. He scrambled down toward the alleyway and whatever else was going to happen next. Chapter 73. I heard LaRue moaning as I finally arrived on the roof of the north building with three uniforms. "Where is he?" I said, hurrying around the corner of the elevator housing. "He's gone," LaRue said, crazed, bent out over the edge, looking north and then west. "Gone? How?" I said. "Where?" He continued to stare out at the buildings. "The cable's there, look," he said, pointing at some cell site tower cables hanging down the back of the building behind the elevator house. "That's impossible," I said. "He's dead then." I looked down at the shadowed alley far beneath. "The cables are too far off this edge. Spider-Man couldn't do it." "Well, he did it. We need to get someone down there now. What's that low building there between us and the train track?" "Stan Sports Bar. Don't worry, if he's down there, we got him," I said as an NYPD Aviation Bell helicopter came in low from the south. "We're surrounding the block. He's not..." I wasn't able to finish the sentence because the boom, boom, boom of a gun started below, to the west, by the River Avenue side of the sports bar. I couldn't see what was happening because of the elevated track. The initial shots were followed by two more, and then there was a high shriek of tire rubber. It took us just over 2 minutes to fly down the stairs and come out onto River Avenue under the giant rusting jungle gym of the elevated track. This close to the stadium, the whole low block was sports bars and souvenir shops. Everything red, white, and blue, with Budweiser signs and Yankees billboards everywhere. We came upon Arturo first. He was across from the front entrance of the bar, down on his butt in the gutter, surrounded by half a dozen people. As I ran up, I saw that he was clutching an apron to his blood-soaked leg.
"Forget me! Help Sophie! Over there!" he said, pointing farther north, where three people were kneeling beside someone propped up on one of the elevated track's steel legs.
LaRue ran over and knelt by his wife. A second later, he had her down on the asphalt and was doing chest compressions on her. When her head lolled to the side, I could see blood, stark and wet, in the white blonde of her hair. I knelt down and helped Arturo shimmy over and sit back against the tire of a parked car. He looked pale, too pale. A train clattered past overhead. Job one was keeping him from going into shock. I held down his hand when he tried to lift the apron to look at his leg.
"Talk to me, brother. What happened?"
Arturo took a breath.
"Just as we were running up to surround the block, like you said, he comes out the front door, stands here."
"The Brit?" He nodded.
"He walks out almost right into us with the Glock in his hand. Sophie, who was a little bit ahead of me, got the drop on him before he spotted us. She put her gun to his head, got him on his knees. I'm coming up behind him with the cuffs, and then pop, pop, pop behind us. It was some bitch in the car shooting from the open driver's window."
"What kind of car was it?" I said, motioning to one of the cops behind me to call it in.
"A silver Ford, a Focus or something, maybe a rental. It went south downriver," Arturo said. "It was some kind of submachine gun or something, Mike. After I took one in the leg, I was able to drop down behind a pillar, but Sophie got caught out. She tried to run, but the bitch just lit her up.
I patted his back as he started crying.
It was so brutal, so messed up, he said.
Hang in there, pal. They're coming. It's going to be fine. I looked over at LaRue, 10 feet away on the street, pressing against his wife in the L's tattered shadow.
They're coming, I said.
Chapter 74. 11 o'clock that night, I found a parking spot on the corner in front of my West End Avenue building. After I shut the engine, I sat for a moment and looked out through the windshield at the traffic and buildings and the stoplight down on 96 swaying in the cold wind. Just as I was about to push open the door, I tensed up and smacked at the steering wheel with the palm of my hand 6 times as hard as I could. I guess you could say I was a tad frustrated. I just left the Bronx's Montefiore Hospital's intensive care unit, where Sophie LaRue was in a coma. She'd been shot 4 in the lower abdomen, and they had to take out 1/2 her pancreas. There had been complications with the surgery, and she'd lost a ton of blood and was now clinging to life by a thread. The look on Matthew LaRue's face when I left was terrible to behold. Having lost my own wife, Maeve, to cancer, I actually knew how it felt to helplessly watch a person you deeply love hover between life and death. How the inconsolable pain of it buries you to the point where the thought of your own death is actually a hope and a comfort. I felt incredibly bad for the both of them. Since 9/11, so many heroes in the military and intelligence services, like the LaRues, were out there on the front lines taking the hits for all of us. And did anyone even notice anymore? Or care? Speaking of hopelessness, we hadn't found the Brit. I'd gone back to the stadium to the luxury booth where we had spotted him, but the man who had rented it, some British banker by the name of David Chester, had left. I traced him to the Carlisle Hotel and then out to Teterboro Airport, only to find he had just taken off for London in his private jet. Dear holy Pete, did it piss me off that some rich English jackwad actually knew the assassin? Matthew LaRue's boss, Everard, said he was putting pressure on the State Department, which was putting pressure on the Brits, to talk to Chester and figure out who the assassin was. But I knew what a load of hooey that was. If Chester had the kind of connections that a transatlantic private jet suggested, there was no way he would ever admit to knowing or consorting with an assassin. None. His lawyers would drag their asses on this like there was no tomorrow. While for Sophie LaRue, there actually might not be one. I couldn't believe this assassin had slipped away from me for the 2nd. He'd reached out and almost killed another one of us, and we still were no closer to finding him. I was staring out at the lonely street when there was a knock on the passenger window. I smiled as I turned to see that it was Mary Catherine. I reached over and opened the door. "Where are you off to on this cold, bitter night?" I said as she sat next to me and closed the door. "Back to Ireland? I wouldn't blame you, you know. Heck, maybe I'll go with you. It's getting dangerous around here."
"I saw the car. When you didn't get out, I got worried," she said. I squeezed her hand. "Rough day," she said.
"Yep, situation normal there," I said. "How about upstairs, about the same? How's Brian's grounding going?"
"About what you'd expect. The surly level is even higher than usual. I think he's got his headphones actually crazy glued to his ears now, but he's home at least. No more mysterious late-night library runs."
"Well, thank God for small mercies," I said as I reached over her and opened the car door and slid out after her.
"Did you eat?" she said as we headed for the front door of the building.
"I thought about it."
"Well, you're in luck," she said with a smile. "I made fried chicken."
"You don't understand precisely how good that sounds right now," I said. "Have you eaten already?"
"No," she said. "I was waiting for you."
She'd wait for me forever, I realized, as I watched her walk ahead of me to the door.
Are you actually going to make her? Asked the voice in my head.
Part 4. Nowhere to Hide. Chapter 75. Noon, 2 days later, found me on Queens Boulevard, staring up at a building that was 12 tall stories of ugly. It was a dirty beige brick, 70s style, residential high-rise that looked pretty much exactly like a giant cardboard box with windows. There were lots and lots of windows, 84 of them to be exact. I'd counted them with my spotting scope 3 times already, looking for a rifle barrel. Vladimir Putin had finally come to New York for the UN summit, and Paul and I and the rest of our task force were following him around. He'd just come in from Kennedy, and his first stop was here on Queens Boulevard in Kew Gardens, Queens, of all places. There was a restaurant of a long-lost cousin of his or something, and he'd just gone in with his brutish personal security detail for some back slaps and vodka shots. It had fallen on us to stand watch and make sure that he didn't get any of the non-vodka kind of shots to his head, which was ironic since we still didn't know if he was behind the ongoing stalking of our own president by the still-missing assassin, the Brit. Paul, I gotta say, this international relations shit is truly pissing me off, I said, as we sat in an FBI van parked in the greasy alleyway between the Russian restaurant and a run-down funeral home. I mean, here we are busting our horns protecting this jackwad from getting taken out, when what we probably should be doing is slapping cuffs on him for trying to take out President Buckland. I mean, how the hell does this make even the slightest bit of common sense? Mike, please, where have you been? Paul said, from behind me, where he was sitting with some of the FBI's hostage rescue.